Serve It Cold, episode 21. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios. Goat? Yeah, we all made it safe and sound down to the quarter. Narlene staying with the Tommies. Yeah, just like before. There's nothing to worry about there. Nothing like the trouble coming out of Catherine. Ah, you must not have seen the news tonight, would be my guess. Why? Because no sooner does Johnny C get the whole affair all figured out, how Latimer Grantham masterminded his brother Landis's cold-blooded killing with an assist from Ragonet, then the sorry SOB has the extremely poor judgment to go and get run over by that damn blue Ford Stratus we've been looking for. Twice. In front of 22 witnesses, no less. No, Latimer. Yes, at Lamar Park, near the walking trail where we were today. The Stratus jumped the curb and hit him, then swung back around and hit him again just to be sure. No kidding, Goat. Oh, Gojo called Johnny with the news while the rest of us were sitting around the Tommy's apartment eating dessert. Officer Barton has been out of touch, which should tell you that the cops don't know what's going on any more than Johnny does. We did hear that Ragonet has a history of auto-related crime, something called the New Orleans honeymoon scheme, which apparently involves running people over when they least expect it. Who'd have guessed that? Yeah, we're still on for early tomorrow morning at Ragonet's quarter apartment, although I'd be surprised if Johnny's awake, much less of any use in a tussle at that hour.
Smell is the most powerful link to memory, isn't it? I can still remember every nuance of smell in that flaring match, but I don't really remember why I was so determined to try the blueberry that night. I never really liked pot. Was I wishing that a couple of puffs of magic ganja would send us down the rabbit hole to the erotic space where Latimer and Lily had played just two nights before? That scene had certainly been playing through my head back in Catherine when I was carefully rolling the small joint while Vera finished packing. Yes, it was smell then, too. I had attached that thick, wet, smoky, sweet aroma to the bright, shiny, over-the-top eroticism of Lily Banks Grantham. But that was before Latimer had been killed, back when I still lived the delusion that I had a handle on this case. Rule number one, control is always an illusion. The sulfur from the match was still stinging my nostrils as I took the first toke. I quickly passed the joint to Vera as a tiny ball blossomed and then exploded in my lungs, causing me to cough out the heavy smoke. I tried to say, "Guess I'm out of practice," but the words were lost in a fit of coughing. As I tried to catch my breath, I could already feel the buzz singing into my temporal lobes. And suddenly it was all very funny. Through watery eyes, I could see that Vera was doubled over, holding the joint blindly toward me. I took a second toke as soon as I could catch my breath. And then we laughed. We laughed out loud until we couldn't breathe. We giggled while we gasped for breath and guffawed at our attempts to calm down. I keeled over in spasms at the thought of the word guffaw, although I was totally unable to transmit the sheer hilarity of the word to Vera because I had lost all control of my jaws. This fact was, of course, extremely humorous. It was okay, though, because Vera was crawling around on the floor at the time, periodically collapsing into a ball of guffaws. This went on for an unknown number of hours. There was, indeed, touching, kissing, hugging. But it's somehow hard to generate the heat of passion when every caress is accompanied by squeals of laughter. My discreet wake-up tap at the door came at 5:30, as ordered. I opened one eye to find myself looking at Vera's right heel. This struck me as funny, but when I tried to laugh, pain shot along my ribcage. It took me a while to extricate myself from the tangle of Vera and bedclothes that I was knitted into, but I made my way to the door where I found a tray with a fresh carafe of Kona, another of orange juice, and an assortment of bagels, brie, and sweet rolls. I was starving. I considered that if I were very quiet, that I might be able to eat the whole tray before Vera woke. After all, she didn't have to get up early. I should let her rest. As I set the tray down on the table, I heard a voice from the sleeping alcove.
Coffee? Food?
Don't laugh. She, of course, thought this was funny, but her first chuckle ended in a yelp.
Oh, goddammit. Johnny Speed, what have you done to me?
I opened the drapes to let the soft light of pre-dawn into the suite and help Vera disentangle herself from the sheets. We ate and drank, everything, in silence. Then she crawled back into the big bed, and I stumbled into the super shower. Things were still a bit hazy that morning, even after the pounding by the water jets in the shower. I felt that I was moving in slow motion. I was 10 minutes late for my breakfast meeting with Sonny. He was already sitting at a table at Poppy's Grill on St. Peter's when I walked in. I sat down without talking. He looked up from the gambit he was reading and said,
"Johnny C., you're stoned."
"No, I'm just getting a slow start this morning." He snorted and turned back to his paper. I scanned Poppy's early morning crowd. The grill had already ridden out the 2:30 rush, the 4 o'clock rush, and was now tackling the 6 o'clock rush, which was composed of the usual mix of late-nighters and early risers. I recognized some of the regulars. Young Elvis had his corner booth staked out. He had probably done 5 shows the night before, but here he was in jeans and a crisp denim jacket with its collar turned up, looking refreshed as if he had just risen from 8 hours of sleep. The fact that Heartbreak Hotel was playing on the jukebox told me that he had already spent his usual handful of quarters to hear the King belt out the same songs that he himself had sung all night long. "You know, sometimes young Elvis makes me sick. The man is way too cheerful." Sonny chuckled without looking up. The 3 tables in the back had the usual gaggle of street kids. These tables always seem filled to capacity, although there's a steady stream of kids coming and going. These guys didn't look quite as refreshed as young Elvis. In fact, most of them looked like I felt. The cab driver table was perpetually occupied. And then there was the table of mimes. Now, mimes are creepy enough one at a time, but to see a whole table full of them is almost too much. These guys were already on mime time, sitting silent but expressive, small gestures and exaggerated looks substituting for conversation. I knew from experience that they would be even more disturbing at the end of the day, when they would be back in Poppy's talking in loud, disused voices. Rule number 2, 1 silent mime? Creepy. 5 talking mimes? Wrong. Just wrong. Kevin the waiter showed up at our table and collapsed into a chair. He pointed to me and said,
"JC, you look as tired as I do, and I bet you didn't stay up all night. You want your usual? I think I could drag it up from my long-term memory."
"Sure, but give me a Diet Coke instead of the malt. I've already eaten 1 breakfast. Imagine the shake machine's still broken anyway."
"Right you are, honey. Some things never change."
"Why don't you just throw the damn thing out the back door?"
"Bobby would never do that, and then we would have to change the menu. Of course, he doesn't want to pay to fix the machine either."
Sonny looked up from the menu.
"So, what's the usual?"
I looked up to Kevin. He wrinkled his brow and put a forefinger to his temple.
"Okay, I think it's coming in now. 1 cheeseburger cooked under a hubcap to the rare side of medium rare, dragged through the garden with 2 eggs sunny side up on top, french fries and a side of grits."
"Very good. I'm impressed."
"Just remember to show how much you're impressed with your tip, JC."
He looked over to Sonny.
"A hubcap?"
"An American hubcap, no less. That's what makes them the best burgers in the world."
"Okay, give me the usual. Without the eggs, the cheese, the fries, and the grits. Oh yeah, and change the Diet Coke to coffee."
When Kevin left, Sonny asked me,
"Do you have the address?"
"Yeah, I've got it here somewhere." I dug my wallet out of the front pocket of my jeans and pulled out the slip of paper that Narlene had given me. We've got to give it to her. Miss Congeniality has a steel trap memory. I can't even remember my own address sometimes. Sonny looked at the piece of paper.
Yeah, I think that's the same place Raggedy had back when I was in Margaritaville. I've never been to his apartment, but I've seen the one under it.
He grabbed a napkin and started sketching out a rough floor plan. I felt someone brush past me from behind and automatically scooted forward. It's the curse of big men eating in the close clutter of high-volume restaurants. As I turned back to Sonny, I noticed the green-haired girl moving back toward the back of the restaurant and realized that I had stuffed my wallet into my back pocket. I was already rising as I tapped the back of my butt to confirm what I knew. She was heading to a back corner booth, where Yellowhead was already sitting, trying hard not to watch me. Sonny, the guy in that back booth. Don't let him leave. I headed straight back toward the bathrooms, and suddenly veered across the room to squeeze into the booth where a girl was still settling herself. I reached out and snapped a handcuff around her left wrist before she could react. She immediately jerked her arm down hard, but the other cuff was anchored to my wrist. She wasn't going anywhere. There was a brief and violent struggle. It was sort of like trying to give medicine to a cat, but she quickly settled down to trying to kill me with her glare. Hello, blue hair.
Hello, color fucking blind.
First things first, wallet. Across the table, Yellowhead was getting fidgety. You gonna run off and leave her?
She can take care of herself.
No doubt, but you won't make the door. My partner is faster than he looks.
Which partner?
The one who's looking at you, genius.
Oh, you mean the one somebody's already beat the shit out of? That guy.
I had almost forgotten that Sonny's face was still a bit colorful for public consumption. Yellowhead. Yeah, you. Look at my eyes when I tell you this. The guy that gave him that died last night. So go ahead. Give it a shot. I couldn't tell if he swallowed the lie or not, but he quit jumping around. Meanwhile, the girl had been busy picking the lock on the handcuff. We had another quick round of medicine cat, and she ended up with the handcuff on her right hand this time. Okay, let's start over. I'm not a cop. Where's my wallet?
You're not a cop? Then this is kidnapping.
Maybe. Maybe not. I'm a bail bonds enforcement agent, and you fit the description of a skip I'm carrying papers on. Anita Bryant. But, damn it, somebody lifted my wallet. Maybe the parish prison will let you stay there until I can get another copy of the paperwork mailed from Ypsilanti. What do you think, blue hair? There was a moment of silence. Then my wallet flew out of the bag she had in her lap and landed on the table. I picked it up and examined the contents.
It's all there.
Good. I pulled out a 20 and laid it on the table.
We're not fucking beggars.
Of course not. Begging is an honest line of work. This is for the lesson you gave me. I know better than to put this thing in my back pocket. And you should know better than to work in Poppy's. You could end up eating all your breakfast sitting on the sidewalk.
Hell, I couldn't help it. I was almost falling out anyway. Why did you call me blue hair?
I watched you two play those Boy Scouts in the crowd at the corner of Toulouse and Royal the other day. It's very slick. That was a dangerous game you played. If you're lucky enough to get a little older, you'll learn that just waking up every morning can be thrill enough. She had a shocked look on her face. She was wondering how it was possible that she didn't see me and how I saw her. I pulled out a business card and laid it on the table. Here's my contact information. I cannot and will not help with any legal difficulties you manage to get yourselves into. But if you get into a jam, or need a ride, or a place to crash for a while, call me. The shock had now turned to pure suspicion. I dropped another card on the table, face down, and continued. What I want in return is an email address.
I look like I got email?
Yes. You look like you've got several accounts. Give me one that you check regularly.
Why?
Because I've watched you work. You are both cool under pressure and have great hands. I might can use you sometime for something that's not quite as likely to end up with you in jail.
As bounty hunters?
Maybe. Maybe something else. Listen, I'm just like most people I know. I'm a multitasking son of a gun. I don't want your names. For me, you're blue hair and he's yellow head. Just give me an address.
Son of a gun, how quaint.
She looked at Yellowhead. She shrugged, scribbled something on the card. I got back to my own table just after the food. I found a bottle of Visine beside my burger. I looked at Sonny, questioning.
Kevin left it. He said, you look stoned as hell. What was that all about? Did I just see you pay someone for picking your pocket?
Job interview.
Who's interviewing who?
That, Sonny, depends on who grabs the brass ring first. I glanced over to the corner table. The cut purse couple had slipped away. I could see that the 20 was still lying on the table, but my card was gone. Even with all the hijinks in the restaurant, we got to Raganet's place well before 7. I had my trusty cane, and Sonny assured me that he wouldn't fall victim to any tire tools this time around. Our plan was simple. We would run a version of what I'd threatened Blue Hair with. If we found Raganet, we would subdue him and call Ken. We would swoop in and take him to the Pearl River County Jail in Mississippi, where an old friend of Big John's was a deputy. The deputy would hold him on suspicion of being a skip for 24 hours. During that time, it would come to light that he wasn't the skip in question, but a hit-and-run artist who was wanted for 2 murders in Catherine. Voila! Do-it-yourself extradition to Mississippi. First, we carded the ancient door leading to the courtyard tunnel, a 3-second task with my library card. Then, standing on the street, we rang the buzzer a couple times and listened for a far-off sound that would tell us if the thing was actually working. It was all silence to me, but Sonny, with his young ears, swore that he could hear a buzz. He walked down into the tunnel so he could watch the apartment door while I buzzed. I pressed the button down for a good 40 seconds or so while I heard someone coming up the intercom.
Ray. Ray, that you? What the fuck is up, bro? You lose your keys?
I shut the door behind me and ran down the passage to catch up with Sonny. I went up the 2 flights as quickly and quietly as a stoned, 350-pound middle-aged man could negotiate creaking and groaning 200-year-old stairs. At the top, I took one look at the new lock and jam and shook my head. We weren't going to card this one. I was trying to figure out where to stand on the tiny landing to kick the door without falling into the courtyard when the doorknob started to turn. Sonny grabbed a fire escape ladder and swung both legs up over my head and then down into the door. There was a loud crack, and Sonny followed the flying door into the apartment. By the time I made it inside, Sonny and Jerry Joachim were standing on opposite sides of the small kitchen, all wooshooed up. I felt like I was on the set of a Bruce Lee movie. They even did that little bow to each other. The effect was slightly diminished by the fact that Jerry was still wearing Narlene's turquoise blouse. I quickly scanned the kitchen for weapons, and in doing so, missed the whole fight. I heard a thump and turned around to find Jerry lying on the floor with one arm twisted at an odd angle and blood streaming down the sides of his face. Wow. Did you kill him?
Nope.
Good, I guess. Remind me to get a gallon of that wushu juice the next time I go to Sam's Club. Sonny didn't laugh. Okay, continue to not kill him while I look around. I lifted my cane to my shoulder like a baseball bat and moved into the second room of the apartment. It looked like a trailer park after the tornado, but held no bad guys. I moved into the bedroom that Narlene had barricaded herself into. The butcher knife was still buried to the hilt in the mattress. There was nobody hiding under the bed or in the tiny shower of the bathroom. Narlene's opened overnight bag was also sitting on the bed. I figured that Jerry wouldn't have bothered toting the bag very far from its hiding place, and quickly found the crude trap door cut into the wall that separated the bedroom from the kitchen. Even with Narlene's bag gone, the hidey hole was impressively filled with gallon Ziplocs full of drugs. I pulled on a pair of latex gloves before going further. I dug through the pile and found no weapons. Then I pulled a few bags out, opened them, and slung the contents around the room. Rocks of crack, caps of speed, and tiny pills of OxyContin scattered everywhere. Finally, I stuffed every piece of clothing that looked more like Narlene than Jerry into the bag. When I got back to the kitchen, I found Sonny still standing over Joachim, watching him bleed. I asked, "Is he dead now?"
"No. He's awake now. He's playing possum."
Jerry's eyes opened. He groaned a couple of times and said,
"Oh, that's the thanks you give me, bro?"
Sonny's eyes flared.
"Bro, What the hell you call me that for, asshole?
I saved your life the other night, man. Ray was gonna waste you right then and there.
Oh, yeah, I remember now. You saved my life right after you snuck up behind me and hit me with a piece of rebar. Thanks a lot, bro.
He leaned down, and Joachim rolled into a fetal position. I decided that I needed to take my leave again. I went back to the bedroom and used my pocket knife to cut the cleanest dirty sheet into strips. I had noticed that the kitchen sink was already heaped with stinking dishes, so I went into the bathroom and rummaged around until I found an old bottle of bleach, undoubtedly left by a previous tenant. I ran a sink full of hot water and added a good measure of bleach before adding the sheet strips. I opened a few more bags of drugs and scattered them around while the water cooled a bit. Then I lugged the bleach-soaked lump of cloth back into the kitchen and dropped it into a metal folding chair there. Joachim was now propped up against the stove, with Sonny sitting in a modified lotus position in front of him. It was obvious that neither man was one who needed to fill their time together with talk. They sure weren't kin to me. I pulled up another metal chair and threw a pair of gloves to Sonny. Here, it's your turn to play nurse. My daddy always said that if you catch him, you clean him. I'll play Grand Inquisitor today. Be careful and don't step in the blood. That's what I did for 30 minutes while Sonny doctored on Joachim. It was readily apparent that the fight didn't explain all the guy's condition. Apparently, he had pretty much been living on drugs for the last week and was as loopy as I felt. On the positive side, he hardly seemed to notice when Sonny wrenched his shoulder back into place. He did have two strong convictions which he tended to announce every minute or so, that he had saved Sonny's life, and that I was the fat bastard who stole Narlene's pot. He wasn't too sure about anything else, but he was willing to talk about everything else once I got him started. The drugs belonged to Ray. Ray had left for Catherine to do a big job and never came back. He didn't know what day it was or how many days Ray had been gone. He was working for somebody named Grantham, and no, Joachim had never met Grantham. Somebody stole the car, and all the money was in the trunk. They had lots of money and lots of drugs, and they were going to be rich and buy more drugs. He was ambivalent about Narlene. One minute Narlene was lost and needed to be found. The next minute Narlene was the bitch that cut his balls off. I was sure Narlene would be pleased to learn that she had made such a strong impression. And, of course, I was the fat bastard that stole Narlene's pot right after he saved Sonny's life. Even though he was pretty coherent, it became obvious that there just wasn't much reliable information to be had here. Raganet had enough smarts to keep his partner way out of the loop. We got him off the floor and sat him in my chair. I went and got a bag of mollies and a small bag of crack rocks. I opened both and threw the stuff all over the kitchen and into the living room. I crouched in front of him with another bag of speed and said, "Jerry, pay attention. See this?" And strewed the yellow caps all over the floor. "I've done this with 5 bags of this shit. You'll never be able to find it all. You understand me, Jerry?" I pulled out my cell phone and held it in his face. "See this?" He nodded his head. "I'm going to use this phone to call the New Orleans Police Department Monday morning. That's 3 days from now. I'm going to tell them that you are selling drugs up here in this apartment. They'll come and look, and even if you run, they're going to find your fingerprints all over the place here. Jerry, Ray's not coming back. He's got every cop in Mississippi after him for killing this Grantham guy he told you about. What you need to do, Jerry, is cut up another sheet and get some of that bleach in the bathroom and wash your fingerprints off everything. The dishes, the walls, the floors, the furniture, everything. Then you sell some of these drugs and you get some clothes and a train ticket, and you've got to lay off the meth or you're going to stroke out. You got me?" He was nodding all through this monologue, as if everything I said was making perfect sense. "One more thing, Jerry. You're going to end up in court one of these days, and if I hear that you even say the name Narlene to the cops or to the district attorney, I'll use this phone to call the Dixie Mafia and tell them that it was you that stole all these drugs from them. You got that?"
"Narlene's lost, man. I've got to go find her. You think she stole my car?"
Suddenly, he looked me straight in the eye.
"You've been smoking that purple shit. You're the fat bastard that stole Narlene's pot, and you smoked it all up.
I shrugged my shoulders and said to Sonny, Let's go. I think we're done here. Back on the street, we walked in silence for a couple of blocks before I had to ask, Sonny, what gives? You're acting like your pet hamster died.
I'm all right. I just hate to see anybody strung out like that. That could have been me a few years ago. And, you know, you really did save my life.
I reached over and put my arm on his shoulder. Then gave him a push toward the traffic on busy Decatur Street. Then pulled him back by his collar just as fast. There. I just saved your life, too. And I'm going to have to go wake up Vera Hill with the worst hangover in her life. Worry about me for a change. He laughed then, and I started thinking about a getaway brunch.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com. Or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com. It is our very great pleasure to introduce you to Tori Anderson and Possum Holler. Check out their website, www.possumhollerband.com. That's POSSUMHOLLERBAND.com for tour dates and appearances. Or you can pick up a copy of their critically acclaimed album, Substantially Blue, at CDBaby.com. And now it's time to check in at the Heartbroke Hotel. You can pick up your crying towels at the front office.
Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. It was down the end along the street at Heartbreak Hotel. I guess you know me, baby. I guess you know me. So lonely I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for the broken-hearted lovers to cry. crooks dressed in black. They've been so long down on the street. They never coming back. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely. I get so lonely, I could die. Tale to tell. Just take a walk down on the street to Heartbreak Hotel. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely. I get so lonely, I could die. I get so lonely.
But now I see.